Spring thaw. There was a guy in my Spanish class named David who knew all these obscure facts about all these great literary figures from Latin America and Spain. I was tremendously impressed by this guy, but he wasn't really a friend of mine. He kept to himself a lot. But he seemed to be really very cosmopolitan, sort of a Renaissance man, and when you could draw him out in a conversation, which wasn't so easy to do, he was fascinating. David was part of a big thing in 1960. The House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC, was going around the country with their anti-communist crusade, and they came to San Francisco. Before then, there had been people who had testified before HUAC who had been defiant. But now a lot of people, more than 1,000, I believe, demonstrated against HUAC in San Francisco. This was a massive outpouring, the first time that people stood up against HUAC in a mass public way. I was an aspiring poet, and that day I'd gone off to a conference of high school poets around Northern California. But I'd gotten back in time for Spanish class, and I'd noticed that David wasn't there. So the next day I asked him where he'd been. He explained that he was at the demonstration against HUAC. He and a number of other kids from my school who went to the demonstration talked about how they'd been attacked by the police, how fire hoses were used to drive them down the steps of the courthouse, and how it was a big outrage. It became a big deal politically in the society as a whole, and they were all very proud that they'd been part of this. I was really envious of them. I felt like I'd really missed out on something important, and I asked them a lot of questions about it. So it was kind of a spring thaw. A lot of things were busting loose. A lot of intellectual and cultural ferment was going on. The Beats were breaking out. They had started up in Greenwich Village in Manhattan and had come to North Beach in San Francisco. I remember William Buckley came to debate some liberal about the First Amendment, loyalty oaths, and all that kind of stuff. And Buckley started these disgusting antics to distract the audience while the liberal was talking. At the time, I was, of course, still strongly opposed to communism and accepted all the conventional wisdom, or unwisdom, about communism and how horrible it was. I remember asking David, "Well, are you a communist?" after he told me about the HUAC demonstration. He said, "No, but I hate HUAC." And then he explained why he hated it and everything it stood for. So this was a very exciting time. A lot of the girls I knew were influencing me at the time, including the Japanese-American girls that I ate lunch with, who were interested in a lot of different artistic and intellectual questions. Just as a side point, I remember one of them telling a story about Marlon Brando. She was talking about her grandmother, who had come from Japan and lived with their family and spoke no English, was watching a movie about Japan. Brando was in it, and at one point he spoke Japanese. And this girl told me that her grandmother said that if she closed her eyes when Brando was speaking, she couldn't tell he wasn't Japanese. For some reason, that story stuck with me. I later came to really like Marlon Brando, for a lot of other reasons, and actually met him at the time of a rally in support of the Black Panther Party in Oakland. There were other girls I knew from my classes who had an impact on me. One of them even said something to me to the effect of, "You know, when you were in junior high school, you were a real jerk, but now you're a much better person." So there was a kind of mutual or reciprocal thing there where we influenced each other. They played an important part in getting me interested in poetry, in philosophy, and a lot of the general intellectual ferment that was going on. Of course, it wasn't only girls. This kind of ferment was going on pretty broadly among a number of my friends and people I knew, both boys and girls. But it was significant and kind of a new thing for me that I developed close relationships with a number of girls, not as girlfriends, but just as friends who happened to be girls. And that was also a lesson for me, because I had had more of a traditional view of girlfriends before then, and I really didn't have very many friends who were girls. I remember a few teachers very fondly from that time. Ms. Bentley was an English teacher who had us read a lot of Shakespeare. And I remember one time I deliberately set out to write a paper about Macbeth to prove a thesis that I actually didn't believe. For some reason, I just thought it would be fun and provocative to do this. But she got so furious at me that she wrote on the bottom of the paper, "You have too good a mind to be an intellectual ambulance chaser." I was really angry with her at the time, but she had a point. She didn't want to see whatever abilities I was developing misused for what she saw as paltry purposes. But she encouraged me to write, as well as opening me up to reading a lot of different things and seeing the value of that. I also learned a lot from Ms. Rodriguez, my senior year history teacher. Later on, she quit teaching, and after I heard about this, I wrote her a letter trying to argue with her to stay on because she was such a good teacher. She left anyway, but people like her had an influence on me, broadening my vistas about a lot of things. On the other hand, when I was either a sophomore or junior, we had this real old-school history teacher. One day we got into class and she said, "Today we're going to see a movie about isms." And we saw this movie that was the equivalent of Reefer Madness about communism and socialism. Of course, there was nothing about individualism or capitalism. It was just about socialism and communism. It was like a melodrama with a vile-looking guy who was selling bottles of poison. But instead of having X on them for poison, it said socialism or communism. So a lot of that, even in Berkeley, was still being drilled into the students at that time. Nonetheless, history was one of my favorite subjects. Getting free of religion. About that time, I was becoming an atheist. Ironically, one of the influences that convinced me not to believe in God was Freud, who actually put forward and reinforced some reactionary notions, including in regard to women, but whose critique of religion I found compelling. He tied religion in with the tradition of the powerful father figure, and that influenced me to recognize that religion was a human invention and a human device. At that time, most of my friends were still religious, and in fact, the four of us who hung together all the time, me, Matthew, Hemby, and Joel, all still nominally went to the same church. Mainly, that was because we were playing on the church league basketball team together, and so we sort of had to put in our time in order to legitimately represent the church. Also, I was still living with my parents, still under their aegis, so to speak, and they wanted me to go to church, and I still went, even after I started not believing, which was obviously a source of tension. But the intellectual ferment, getting into philosophy, starting to study history as well as literature and so on, led me to see from a lot of different directions that religion and the idea of God were human inventions. All these different cultures had different ideas of God that conflicted with and contradicted each other. We studied Greek mythology with Ms. Bentley, and you could see that different people in different ages believed in all different kinds of gods, and that some of these had passed out of convention and weren't widely believed in anymore. To tell the truth, losing my religion was more emancipating than upsetting. I talked earlier about how when I was a kid I used to tempt God by saying, "Fuck," and then wondering if God would punish me, and if I should atone for my sins and pray for forgiveness. I know some people say that faith in God gives them a system of belief to live by and to do good things in the world. Even some very progressive people say this. But I found belief in God to be very intimidating, very oppressive and repressive. The Christian religion is full of fear, as is Islam, over what's going to happen to you if you somehow displease God. So while there may have been a time when giving up that set of fairly strong beliefs that I've been raised with shook me up, I increasingly found it emancipating to throw that off, to more look at the world the way it is, and to not have that feeling that something was going to happen to you if you said, "Fuck," or in one way or another, displeased God. I still believe that there was right and wrong. I don't know exactly what I thought it was rooted in, but I just believed that certain things were right and certain things were wrong. Racism was wrong, for instance. You didn't need religion to tell you what was right and wrong, and you didn't need the fear of God to make you do what was right. There were just some things that were right and some things that were wrong, and you acted accordingly. That might have been somewhat naive, and obviously it's not deeply enough rooted to carry you a long, long way. But at that time, it was very emancipating for me. I just didn't feel the need for God. My parents were aware of this, especially once I got out of high school and became more intellectually emancipated, as well as practically emancipated in a lot of ways. I just started voicing my view more, and this was the source of a lot of conflict and tension, and we got into big arguments about it. As for my friends, today there's all this nonsense about how black people are just inherently religious. And that's a whole thing that gets me pissed off. It's just bullshit. These are socially conditioned things. A lot of my black friends, and a lot of people who influenced me later in life, like the Panthers, were going through the same thing I'd gone through, and recognized that these religious ideas and institutions are human inventions, and not very good ones. So some of my friends were still religious, but many of them were going through the same general kind of emancipating experience that I was in casting off religion. Anne Frank. I was in the senior play in high school, The Diary of Anne Frank. I played Peter van Damme, Anne Frank's boyfriend. I never sat down and memorized my lines. I just went to rehearsal all the time, and by the time the play was actually put on, I knew everybody's lines from beginning to end, without ever studying any of them. If you'd plug me in anywhere in the play and give me the first word, I could just go forward from there through the whole play. But I don't think the full heaviness of that story really hit me until a few years later. Obviously, I understood it on a certain level. And even though this was just a senior play in high school, I actually did try to get inside of the play and understand my character and the other characters as well, and really give some expression to it. But still, I was a 17-year-old kid. I hadn't lived through an experience like that. I knew about the Holocaust, but I didn't really have a deep understanding of it. I got that later, when I went to college and I had more Jewish friends and learned about it more. It wasn't just that I had never experienced anything like that, but I'd also never had relationships with people whose family had gone through that, or who knew people very closely who'd gone through that. That happened a little bit later. So although at the time of this senior play in high school, I knew about the Holocaust, and I was somewhat familiar with the very gripping story of Anne Frank, as I grew and developed, my understanding of it got deepened. Football. Playing on the high school football team was very important to me in a lot of ways. I spoke earlier about how the integrated setting of the team ended up teaching me more than any class that I had. But it was also just important to me as football. And on the level of football itself, in my senior year, things didn't go so well. We usually had a really good team, but that year I think we only won 4 out of the 9 games we played, so that was kind of frustrating. People kept getting injured, people were quitting the team, and the coach was using all these old-fashioned formations which weren't really working, so he kept shifting them. From week to week, everybody had to learn new assignments, which was part of why we didn't have such a successful season. Still, even though we were losing games, it was a lot of fun. We traveled 50 miles to play against a school in Stockton in my junior year, for instance. The socializing was a lot of fun in general, and there would be some occasions like that Vallejo game with the bus ride, where we had that deep talk about racism and discrimination. And we ended up winning that game, and I had a good game that night. So that particular experience was a very positive one. There were other, more frustrating experiences, but overall I have very positive and fond remembrances of this whole experience. Interestingly, when I went to college at Berkeley, and I was starting to practice for the freshman football team, I already started to get the sense that in college it was going to be much more of a serious affair, like a business, and not nearly so much fun as in high school. In high school, whether we won or lost, we had a lot of fun. You lost a game on Friday, and on Monday you'd be back at practice with your friends, and you'd get ready for the next game. If you had a good game, you'd get written up in the paper for having a good game. And if you had a bad game, you had to put up with being written about for having a lousy game. But it was all part of the fun. At the same time, there's a lot of militarism, a lot of macho, a lot of downright misogynistic shit that goes along with sports in this society, that whole dominant sports culture. And that could have had a very negative influence overall if it weren't for the larger things happening in society, and in particular the whole thing breaking loose around black people, which mainly made this a positive experience and a positive influence on me, even though a contradictory one. I played quarterback, and when you're sort of leading a team that's not doing that well, it can be a pretty mixed experience. But I had always been encouraged to play sports by my parents, with my father directly teaching me how to do things, and my mother more generally being very supportive. So I had a lot of confidence. I wasn't intimidated by being quarterback, but I also didn't really think of it that much as being a leader. I just thought of it as a position I want to play, largely because I loved to pass in football, and I developed a pretty good ability to pass. I remember one game when I was playing on the junior varsity, we came from behind to tie the game, and I completed 5 or 6 passes in a row, and then we scored a touchdown, and that felt really good. But I never thought of myself as the field general. I just thought, okay, I'll call the plays, and I sort of led the team in a general sense. But more was that I liked this position because I loved to pass the ball. I thought that passing, if you could really do it well, was a beautiful art. That's the way I looked at it. I also loved track, and our school always had really good track teams. In my younger sister's class, there was a guy named Jerry Williams, who was a great sprinter. He broke all kinds of records and had a beautiful running style. My friend Matthew was on the track team as well as the football team, and he won the state meet one year in the shot put. Later on, he didn't like his college shot put coach, so he asked me to coach him. I didn't really know that much about it, so I had to go read up on it. Anyway, I really loved track and basketball, and I went to almost every one of our school's basketball games and almost all the track meets. During my senior year, there was a league track meet leading toward the state championship meet. I really wanted to go to this track meet, but it started at something like 2 p.m. on a school day and was an hour drive away. I was able to get my parents' car for that day. Of course, I didn't tell them what my plan was. I don't like to come into sporting events after they start. I wanted to see the meet from the very beginning. But it started at 2, and I didn't get out of school until 3, and if I left then, it would be almost 4 o'clock, and I'd miss more than half the meet. So I devised a plan where I got a friend of mine, who had a very deep bass voice, to call up the school attendance office during lunch break and pretend to be my father. "This is Spurgeon of Aitken. I'll be coming in today at 1 to pick up my son to take him to a dentist's appointment." So I was sitting in my Spanish class, and they sent me a note saying, "You're supposed to meet your father outside at 1 to go to a dentist appointment." Of course, I went out and got in the car and drove to the track meet. A vice principal in the school, who was also an assistant coach on the football team, saw me at the track meet early, but since he sort of liked me and knew me from the football team, he just came up to me a few days later and asked, "Wasn't that you at the track meet about 2:15? I said, "Are you sure you saw me there?" And he just kind of let it slide. But then a couple of days later, the attendance office called me in, and they asked me, "What's this about how you were supposed to go to a dental appointment, and instead you showed up at the track meet?" I don't know if it was this vice principal or someone else who told, but I said, "Well, it's not my fault. You sent me a note saying I was supposed to meet my father to go to the dentist." I think I got away with it mainly because I was a good student. After the football season in my sophomore year, I went out for basketball, and the coach tried to tell me that I was too short to play on the basketball team. So I just walked off. I'd played with a lot of the guys on the team at the playgrounds, so I knew I could play with him. I knew I was good enough to be on the squad, but I just got pissed off when he told me I was too short. Then, a couple of years later, the basketball coach was my gym teacher, and we used to play basketball in gym class. Finally, one day he comes up to me and he says, "How come you never came out for the basketball team?" I just looked at him, and then I told him, "'Cause you said I was too short." He just got a funny look and walked away. I guess he'd forgotten. Keeping the rep. I still prided myself on my reputation as a teacher's trial. For example, I always tried to get my homework done in study hall, partly because I didn't want to be burdened with homework, and partly because I was trying to cultivate this reputation of someone who's both a wild kind of guy, but also a surprisingly good student who never had to study. Part of that whole image was never carrying books home after school. So I really worked hard in study class, and only rarely did I take books home to study, only if I had to write a paper or maybe study for a test. But sometimes I'd get bored in study class, and I'd think up antics and pranks. There was a teacher in one study class who was this nasty disciplinarian, and everybody hated her. Now, if you were in study class and had to do a makeup test or something, you could be excused from the study class to go do it. So I had a friend of mine write a note saying that I had to go take a Spanish test during the study class, and my friend signed the note with the name of my Spanish teacher. I then walked up to the study class teacher, whom everybody hated, and presented to her this note. She countersigned it, at which point I tore it up and threw it in the wastebasket. I said, "I just wanted to see if I could fool you." She got so furious that she took the note out of the waste paper basket and meticulously scotch-taped it back together and then sent it down to the vice principal in charge of discipline for students. So I got called into the vice principal's office the next day, and my defense was, "Look, I was just having fun. I didn't actually cut study class. I was just trying to see if I could actually fool her, and once I fooled her, I just tore the note up and threw it away. You can see she had to put it back together, so I wasn't really trying to cut class." Once again, I got away with it because I was a good student and let's face it, also because I came from a good home and good family. I also had a physics class as a sophomore, and I think the teacher's name was Mr. Nelson. He was a lively teacher and a pretty good teacher, but he also had this strict thing about no talking out of order in class. You were not allowed to talk unless you were called on by Mr. Nelson himself. This is a rule I found very hard to go along with. He would take points off every time you spoke out of turn in class, and that would take away from your grade average. Even knowing that, there were times when I couldn't resist. One time he was talking about measurements in physics, one named after Isaac Newton, called the Newton, and the other called the Dyne. He asked, "Does anybody know what the equivalency is between Newtons and Dynes?" I wasn't sure I'd get called on, so without raising my hand, I just spoke up and said, "I think